Hey, Keystoners. Welcome back to Keystone State of Mind. It's me, Steph, your tour guide to the dark side of Pennsylvania. Guess what, guys? This is KSOM's 50th episode. That's a pretty big milestone. And to commemorate this special day, I have a really disturbing story for you that was recommended to me by Keystoner Kelly Ann. But first, shout outs. We have a couple of new roadies to welcome, Georgiana and Bill. Thank you guys so much for supporting KSOM on Patreon. KSOM also got a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts from Moons 357 stars. So also, thank you for that. And just a quick announcement. This will be the last episode of KSOM for 2021. There will be 2 more premium episodes coming out for our Patreon supporters, but this is our last regular episode for the year. I'll be back in January with some new crazy stories for you guys. But I am just gonna take it easy for the rest of December and enjoy the holidays. Okay, are you guys ready? Let's get into a Keystone State of Mind. As always, I'll be enjoying an ice cold can of Keystone Light while I tell you today's story. In the early morning hours of May 12, 2007, the Haynes family was attacked in their Lancaster County home. 20-year-old Maggie Haynes awoke to sounds of a struggle at around 2:30 a.m. She ran to her parents' bedroom to find her father bloody and not moving. Her mother was barely alive and in shock. They had been stabbed. With her last breath, Maggie's mother whispered to her, "Go for help." In 2007, the Haynes family consisted of Father Tom. He was 50 years old and the branch manager of an industrial supply company. Mother Lisa. She was 47 and a preschool teacher. Daughter Maggie was 20 years old and was a student at Bucknell University. And 16-year-old Kevin, the youngest of the Haynes family. He was in 10th grade at Mannheim Township High School. The family lived on Peach Lane in Mannheim Township. The Haynes were a very close family. The kids, Kevin and Maggie, were not like your typical teenagers. They weren't off hanging out with their buddies all the time and like doing whatever. They actually enjoyed spending time with their parents. And they enjoyed spending time with each other. In 2007, Maggie was a sophomore at Bucknell University and she lived on campus during the school year. So when she was home, Maggie and Kevin tried to spend as much time with one another as possible. Kevin and Maggie were both very gifted academically. Neither of them had like a big circle of friends. They focused on their family and their studies. Kevin was in 10th grade and he didn't play sports, but he was the star of his school's quiz bowl team. My high school definitely did not have a Quiz Bowl team. Actually, I kind of thought that was just like a movie trope or something. Like, I didn't know high schools actually had such a thing, but apparently they do. And I think it's cool as shit. A competition for students who have intellect over athleticism. It's pretty fabulous. Now, my elementary school did have something similar. It was called the Mathalon. And this was not an all-year thing. It just happened once a year, and the chosen students competed like one time. And it was just doing, you know, competitive math. I was not on the Mathalon team, but my daughter Sunshine was. So that's pretty cool. I would enjoy a Mathalon now as an adult. I don't know if you guys know this, but my college degree is actually in math. I was going to be an actuary, and that never actually happened. I'm a machine operator and an indie podcast host. So, whatevs. But anyways, Kevin was on the Quiz Bowl team, and he rocked that shit. Kevin was described as shy and kind of awkward, but also kind and happy-go-lucky. The whole family could kind of be described this way. They were reserved and kept to themselves, but they were also friendly and very nice. No one really had a bad word to say about any of the Haynes family. And that's why it was so confusing for the investigators of the Manheim Township Police Department when they came onto the scene of this brutal murder. 3 out of 4 of the Haynes family were dead. And finding a motive was going to be really difficult. So let's go back to the day before the murders. Friday, May 11th, 2007. Maggie had just finished her spring semester at Bucknell, so she came home for summer break. In the late afternoon, Kevin and Maggie went out shopping for Mother's Day cards and gifts for their mom. After that, the whole family had dinner together and then watched a movie at home. Kevin and Mom Lisa were tired and went to bed before Tom and Maggie. Tom and Maggie stayed up and watched the end of the Phillies game and went to bed around 11 o'clock. It was a completely normal night, nothing out of the ordinary. That was until about 2:30 in the morning when Maggie woke up to sounds of a violent fight. These sounds were coming from her brother Kevin's room, which was right next door to hers. Maggie may have not initially registered where these sounds were coming from because she didn't run to Kevin's room first. She ran to her parents' bedroom. This could have been because she's woken up out of a dead sleep and confused and just, you know, runs to the people that make her feel the safest. Or she could have, you know, taken the time to figure out that Kevin was being attacked and gone to her parents to get help, rather than just, you know, running in and making herself a target. Maggie strikes me as a clear-headed, quick-thinking person, so I'm going to assume the latter here. Either way, she runs to her parents' bedroom, and this is where she finds her father laying motionless on his bed and bleeding profusely. He wasn't laying like how you normally would in your bed. He was laying crosswise. And her mother, Lisa, was sitting up on the edge of the bed, but she was also bleeding heavily and could barely talk. The only words she was able to get out were, "Go for help." Maggie immediately ran down the stairs and out the front door and pounded on a neighbor's door until they woke up and called 911. By the time the police and first responders got to the home, everyone was dead. Tom, Lisa, and Kevin had all been stabbed and had their throat slit. There was no sign of forced entry, but that really wasn't weird because the Haynes always left their garage unlocked. This was an attached garage that had a door leading into the home, which they also always left unlocked. This was a pretty common practice in the safe community of Manheim Township. There was also no evidence that this was a burglary gone wrong. Nothing was missing from the home. Nothing had been rifled through. This was nothing more than a cold-blooded murder. Investigators were able to surmise that the perpetrator killed Tom first. He had the fewest amount of injuries. Basically, he had his throat slit while he was sleeping and had no time to react before he bled out. Lisa's injuries were a little bit more extensive. She had been stabbed in the face and in the head and in the neck, and her throat was also slashed. Kevin's injuries were the most extensive. He was stabbed in the chest, face, neck, head, over 50 times. Kevin put up a fight. The attack started in Kevin's room when he was sleeping, but once Kevin started fighting back, they spilled out into the hallway, and this was where Kevin eventually bled to death. After the scene was forensically processed, it was determined that the killer had to have taken the knife with them because the murder weapon was not found in the home. Investigators also believed the killer wore gloves because no foreign fingerprints were found. But the killer really didn't seem to give a shit about all the bloody ass footprints he left throughout the whole house. Investigators were able to follow those bloody footprints to the second floor bathroom where the killer cleaned himself up and cleaned the murder weapon. These footprints were a men's size 13. The prints were photographed and would be sent for analysis to try and figure out what kind of shoes these actually were, like what brand or whatever. Police were waiting until first light to search the property. They were able to follow the killer's footprints outside, but, you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever. So they had to wait until the morning to do the exterior search. In the meantime, the investigation focused on the witness and the only surviving member of the Haynes family, 20-year-old Maggie. Investigators became suspicious of Maggie during their first interview. Her story remained consistent, but she had a very flat affect. She was not crying or hysterical. She was incredibly calm and matter-of-fact when answering all of their questions. The police just really did not believe she was acting the way a distraught daughter and sister would act after such a horrific incident. They also couldn't understand why the killer would leave her alive and brutally stab everyone else in the home. Now, police knew that Maggie herself was not the one that committed these murders. They had a dude's footprints, size 13. Now, of course, Maggie could have thrown on guy's shoes and planted false evidence. But when she went to that neighbor's house, she did not have a drop of blood on her. The killer would have been covered in blood. So the fact that Maggie was totally clean from any blood evidence made it obvious that she didn't do the stabbing. But the police were thinking, like, well, maybe she has a boyfriend that didn't like her family. Or maybe she got some guy from college to come down and get rid of her parents and brother. This was an avenue that the investigation would lead down for a little bit. But spoiler, it wasn't Maggie. Maggie had nothing to do with this. Maggie willingly turned over all of her electronics and authorized the police to look through her phone records and her bank transactions, and they found nothing unusual. Police interviewed her friends in Manheim Township and her classmates at Bucknell, even her professors, and they finally came to realize, like, Maggie didn't have a boyfriend and she wasn't in any kind of trouble. She loved her family and she just grieves differently than they expected her to in that moment. The process of clearing Maggie as a suspect took a few days. But let's go back to the morning of May 12th when dawn broke and the forensic team was able to search the Haynes yard and property. A very important piece of evidence was found. This was a baseball cap that had blood and hair on it. The logo of this hat was covered with duct tape. It was obvious this hat had been worn by the killer. And when the blood and hair were analyzed, it was found that it didn't belong to any of the Haynes family. So it must have belonged to the killer. DNA was extracted and was entered into criminal databases, but no match was found. Once Maggie was cleared as a suspect, the investigators took her story at face value. This, in addition to the forensic evidence, led them to another really disturbing conclusion. In Maggie's statement, she said that her mother was alive and sitting up on the edge of the bed. She could barely speak, but she was able to say the words, "Go for help." But when Lisa was found by first responders, she had a large gash in her neck. This gash would have made it impossible for her to sit up and say anything. So the investigators determined that the killer must have went back to Tom and Lisa's bedroom after dispatching Kevin to make sure they were dead. And when he found that Lisa was still alive, he slashed her throat. So Lisa, Maggie's mom, was attacked a second time after Maggie left the house. So the killer had to have still been in the home when Maggie ran out the front door. This conclusion was backed up by the fact that Kevin's body was laying in the hallway when he was found. And according to Maggie's statement, Kevin was not there when she ran down the hallway. This was a horrific, brutal murder of an upstanding family with no obvious motive. The community was terrified. People who used to keep their doors unlocked during the night are now buying home security systems. According to Manheim Township Detective Alan Lead, alarm system purchases increased by 700% in the week following the murders. Everyone was on edge and there was immense pressure on the police department. But the Manheim Township detectives were coming up with nothing. They extensively investigated Tom and Lisa Haynes. They were looking for money problems, large debts, infidelity, addiction issues, and they found nothing. Tom and Lisa were squeaky clean. there was only one person that investigators found that didn't like Tom Haines. And this was a subordinate of his at work at that industrial supply company. Tom had to reprimand this guy or whatever, and he was pissed about it. But this guy had an alibi. He was not involved. And that was the only person police could find that had anything negative to say about Tom and Lisa. So now investigators had to look at the last family member, Kevin Haines. But they didn't really expect to find a whole lot. Kevin was a nice kid. He was shy and super smart. He had no infractions at school, and he was just a happy-go-lucky kid. Kevin only had two close friends. Their names were Benjamin Opp and Alec Kreider. Police interviewed both of these guys, and there were no red flags. Neither of them really had anything to add to the investigation, and they both seemed appropriately upset, like grieving teenage boys who just lost their best friend. Police checked with Benjamin and Alec's parents to confirm that they were actually home in the early morning hours of May 12th. Both sets of parents said, yeah, you know, as far as we know, they were in bed. Neither family had any reason to believe that their boys had snuck out in the middle of the night. After looking into Kevin's life and finding nothing, the investigators were out of leads. They set up a tip line and nothing really came from it. Now, there was a couple of Yahoos from Pennsylvania that were pulled over in North Carolina. These two ding-dongs were pretty much irrelevant to the story, but it's just stupid. I wanted to tell you. These two idiots were in possession of marijuana, so they were taken to the police station. And once they got there, they confessed to the murder of a family in Pennsylvania. So these North Carolina cops are like, well, we better check into this. They find out about the Haines murders and get a hold of the cops in Manheim Township. Like, trade information, interrogate these dumbasses some more. And it came out that they just fucking lied. They just made that up. They didn't even know about the Haines family murders. They were just, I don't know, trying to go to prison for life, I guess. Maybe they thought if they confessed to murder, they'd get out of the possession of marijuana ticket. Whatever. Just a couple of fucking asshats, apparently. The investigation stalled, and police knew that this was one of two scenarios. Either this was a person known to the Haines family, a person that knew they left their garage door unlocked and knew the layout of the house, or this was just a random stranger attack. And we, as Keystoners, know that that happens. Remember back to the case of Adam Leroy Lane, the highway killer. This chump literally just walked around residential neighborhoods trying doorknobs until he found one that was unlocked. He never knew his victims or the layout of their homes. So this is absolutely a possibility in the Haines murders. And the police really had to go down both of these avenues because they didn't have enough evidence to determine which was the actual scenario. A couple weeks into the investigation, the police did get one more piece of evidence. The forensic team was finally able to determine what type of shoes left those bloody footprints. They were men's size 13. Hush puppies. This is new information, but it's not like a big break in the case because lots of people wear hush puppies. I mean, I guess I don't know anyone that wears hush puppies, but I'm sure people do. So that info just went into the file. The slow movement of the case was not for lack of trying on the part of the Mannheim Police Department. They had all hands on deck with this, and all the detectives were working 18 to 20 hour days. One detective, a man named Cleon Bernthysel. Yep, his name is Cleon, like Leon with a C, Bernthysel. He said he was losing sleep out of literal fear for his family and concern for the whole community. So these Mannheim detectives were doing the very best they could. They just did not have enough information. Everyone was taking this tragedy very hard. So it wasn't a big surprise when Alec Kreider started showing signs of severe depression. And remember, Alec Kreider was one of Kevin's best friends. In early June, Alec was talking on the phone to his girlfriend. And this was a girlfriend he'd only been seeing for like a couple of weeks. They had not been in a long-term relationship. But he was talking to her on the phone, and he said he wanted to kill himself, and he was actually holding a loaded gun. This girlfriend wanted to keep Alec on the phone, but she also wanted to alert authorities, like get him some help before something terrible happened. The girlfriend, I think, lived with her aunt or whatever, so she wrote a note to her aunt while she's on the phone with Alec, you know, call the police, Alec's threatening suicide. So the aunt used her cell phone and called police to go over to the Kreider home. Detective Alan Leed was the one who interviewed Alec early on in the investigation. So when the call came in, Detective Leed thought it was best that he be the one to respond. In an episode of Investigation Discovery's Unusual Suspects, Detective Leed said that he was actually afraid of this exact scenario. Like, he wasn't expecting it to happen, but he wasn't surprised that young people that knew Kevin Haynes were in crisis after his murder. Alec Kreider was taken to a psychiatric hospital in Lancaster, where he was on suicide watch for a few days. He was unable to use the phone while he was there, but he continuously wrote letters to his girlfriend. I'm not sure if he mailed them or like gave them to his parents to give to her or whatever, but either way, she never responded. And he was getting really upset. What he didn't know was that the girlfriend's aunt told her, "Oh, you are not hanging out with this boy anymore." So on June 12th, Alec's parents came to visit him, and he's asking about the girlfriend, and they finally had to tell him, like, look, she's not allowed to date you anymore or even talk to you. After hearing this, Alec became very agitated. His therapist was in the room. She said to Alec, "It's time. You need to tell them." And Alec just blurted out, "I did it. I'm the one that killed the Haynes family." His parents were in complete shock. And they're saying, no, you couldn't have done this. And he's like, "Yeah, I did." He told them that he snuck out of his house in the middle of the night, went over to the Haynes home, entered through the door that was always unlocked, and attacked the sleeping family. Alec had confessed this to his therapist earlier that day, and she didn't immediately call the police for some reason. I guess, you know, actually, I have no idea. I have no explanation for that. But she didn't call the police. She waited until Alec could tell his parents. And then the parents did not immediately call the police. They didn't inform the detectives until June 14th, 2 days later. Now I get it. This kind of news is going to take some time to process. You got to like get a game plan. You're going to need an attorney. But I don't think waiting 2 days is a good move. Thankfully, Alec stayed locked up in the psychiatric hospital during that time. When the detectives were finally enlightened about this news, they were shocked. They didn't suspect Alec at all. When they went to the hospital to talk to Alec, he was wearing men's size 13 hush puppies. They also executed a search warrant on the Kreider home and found the murder weapon. It was a large hunting knife that Alec had owned for some time. The knife still had blood residue on it. They also found Alec's journal. And that shit was disturbing. Here are a couple of excerpts from this journal. Quote, "Ever since I was young, I was defiant of rules and their consequences, which of course laid the foundation for my current anger, depression, and violent nature." End quote. Here's another. Quote, "Never did I believe killing a man is wrong. No, no. Killing out of cold blood is wrong. But that is all. I often wondered if I set out to destroy the world, if God would stop me." End quote. Well, this young man fancies himself a dark poet. No, it's just lame. And it's fucking doesn't make any sense. Whatever. And killing a man isn't wrong, but killing someone out of cold blood is wrong. But that's exactly what you fucking did, you weirdo. Okay, whatever. Oh, there's more. Quote, "I despise happy people." End quote. Quote, "Alexander was born May 12th at 3:30, 2007. End quote. Investigators believe that that refers to the date and time of the murder and how killing these three innocent people transformed him into Alexander, whatever the fuck that means. In the days leading up to the murders, Alec also wrote in his journal of his need to kill getting stronger. Those excerpts were taken from the journal that was found in the Kreider home in Alec's bedroom. But Alec also kept a journal while he was in the psychiatric facility, and his therapist finally handed over his therapy journal to the police as well. And this excerpt came from that journal. Quote, "The foolish administrators and doctors of this institution are idiotic enough to ignore the statements, concerns, and warnings in relation to my need to be alone and free." End quote. Well, my friend, you gave up the right to be alone and free when you murdered three people. So, sorry about that. On June 16th, 2007, Alec was arrested at the psychiatric facility and taken to jail. This was really hard for the community to accept or even believe. Alec was a good student. He was smart. He was a nice kid as far as anyone knew. But dude obviously had some demons. The detectives that worked this case truly believed that he was a budding serial killer. And I'm totally fucking on board with that. These journal entries of how he needs to kill or his need to kill is getting stronger. Yeah, that is a serial killer in the making for sure. And if he hadn't been caught for this murder, I would bet at least a paycheck that he would kill again. There's actually a couple more things that lend credence to the idea that he was a sociopath. Kevin's other best friend, Benjamin Opp, said, quote, after the murder, Alex said, I don't know who could have done something so cold-hearted, end quote. That also came from the unusual suspects on Investigation Discovery, which, by the way, I normally trash ID shows, but this one was good. It wasn't fucking corny as shit. I enjoyed it. I actually watched it a few times to get all my notes. That wasn't my only source, but that was probably my main source, I'd say. Another fucked up thing is that Alec actually aced his finals like 2 weeks after he brutally hacked a family to death. Alec's parents did get him an attorney, and this was a guy named Robert Bayer. Put a pin in that because we'll get back to this turd in a little while. I would actually like to physically put an actual pin in this man right now. The initial trial proceedings were to find out if Alec was mentally fit to stand trial and participate in his own defense. And he was found to be those things. He was sane and was going to go to trial. But he was going to lose, and he knew that. They had the murder weapon with blood on it, blood that eventually was linked by DNA to the Haynes family. There was his shoes that he was wearing when he was arrested. They were the same size and brand of shoes that left the shoe print at the murder scene. The shoes also had blood and other, I don't know, matter, whatever, forensic evidence shit on it that linked him to the crime scene. And he also fucking confessed to his therapist, his parents, and police. So eventually, he just pled guilty, good call, to 3 counts of criminal homicide. Oh, hang on. There's one thing I forgot to mention in evidence. Police also found blood-soaked black gloves in Alec's room. So, I mean, yeah, lots of evidence. I just forgot that part. Upon pleading guilty, Alec had to tell the court like what actually happened. And this is what he said. He dressed in all black clothes, including black gloves. He covered the logo on his hat with duct tape. Criminals are so stupid, especially teenage criminals. You cover the logo with duct tape so people don't see the logo and remember it, I guess, or whatever. But then you fucking leave the hat in the yard, you dumb ass. Dumb ass. Whatever. He took a flashlight and his hunting knife and entered through the garage door that he knew was always unlocked. He stabbed Tom first and then attacked Lisa. He then went to Kevin's room, where Kevin fought back fiercely. So this was a really violent attack. I mean, not that the others weren't violent, but, you know, this got crazy. Once he knew that Kevin was dead, he went back to the parents' room. And that's where he found that Lisa was still alive. So he sliced her throat. He then went to the upstairs bathroom to get cleaned up and clean up the murder weapon. After that, he left the same way he came in and walked home. First big question, why didn't he attack Maggie? Well, there's a simple answer for that. It's because he didn't know she was there. He didn't know that she had come home from college, and he said that if he did know she was there, he would have killed her. So let's just quickly think about this timeline. Maggie wakes up while Alec is attacking Kevin in Kevin's bedroom. She runs to her parents' room, sees that they're hurt, and then runs down the hall and out the front door before the fight between Alec and Kevin spilled out into the hall. And the hall that she ran down was this same hall. I mean, like, she ran past Kevin's bedroom door. So the timing is fucking crazy. She had seconds to get down that hallway and out the door before Alex saw her. Is she lucky? Is she blessed? Or, you know, if you're going to look on the darker side, is she unlucky and cursed? Like, she's the only one that survived. I just find that fucking mind blowing that she had a few second window to pass that bedroom door without being seen. And Alec did not know she was there until, like, after the news came out. That's just crazy to me. That is one of the craziest parts of this whole story. The second big question: why did Alec do it? Why did he choose his best friend and his family? Alec never gave a motive. Not to his parents, not to his therapist, not to the police. Never. One of my sources was a Washington Post article written by Christine Phillips in 2017. The district attorney from Lancaster County was interviewed for this article. This guy's name was Craig Stedman, and he's the one that prosecuted this case. He said in this article that he can only think of one reason why Alec Kreider chose the Haynes family. And that's because they were an easy target. He knew the family. He knew the home. He'd been there many times. He knew how to get in, and he knew where to go. But I think there might be another reason why he chose the Haynes. And that's because they were a really happy family. And we know from Alec's writings that he despised happy people. And really, that's the best we're going to get for a motive. Alec pled guilty, so the only thing left was his sentencing. And that hearing occurred in 2008. During this hearing, DA Craig Stedman said that killing energized him. He said, quote, "He was the true pathological killer. He definitely was one of the most frightening and evil people that I've ever prosecuted," end quote. But of course, the defense attorney has a chance to speak. And this is where we pull the pin out of that turd, defense attorney Robert Bayer. He emphasized that Alec was just a boy. Bayer said, quote, "When he was actually charged, people really came down on him. He's a 16-year-old boy with problems," end quote. Yeah, I'll fucking bet people really came down on him. He brutally murdered 3 people in cold blood. I would say we should come down hard on people that do something like that. And I don't really give a fuck how old they are. We got to put the pin back in this guy because we're not done with him. Later, he says some more really stupid shit. There was one more person who got to speak at the sentencing hearing, and that was Maggie Haynes, the only survivor. She didn't go in person. She sent her victim impact statement via video. This clip is about 10 minutes long, but I'm going to play the whole thing. I was going to pick out parts of it to play, but once I heard it, I realized that the entire thing is valid and important. So if you don't want to listen to the whole thing, you can skip ahead like 10 minutes. But I recommend listening to it because I think Maggie Haynes deserves to be heard.
"Dear Honorable Judge Ashford, My name is Maggie Haynes, and I'm the daughter of the late Tom and Lisa Haynes, and the sister of the late Kevin Haynes. I would like to thank you for allowing me to submit a video statement. When my parents and brother were brutally murdered by Alec Kreider on May 12, 2007, my world was shattered. For 20 years, my parents have always been there for me, no matter what. I could not and still cannot comprehend a world without them. I miss them every moment of every day. Some days I don't know how I even manage to function without them. And it's really hard to wake up each morning knowing that I'm the only one left in my immediate family. Since the incident, I have developed post-traumatic stress disorder and often have trouble sleeping at night. I'm also currently seeing a therapist to help me cope with this tragedy. I often feel very alone because no one knows my parents and brother like I do. While my parents' families and friends know my parents, they often don't know much about my brother or me. Kevin's friends know Kevin, but they've never really spent much time with my parents. And my friends at school have been extremely supportive, but many of them have never even met my family. No matter how hard people try, I have found that no one can truly understand what I'm going through. In a way, that is a blessing because I know that no one has experienced what I have. But it's still hard not to have someone to relate to. And I want to stress that I was a mere 20 years old when this happened. My biggest concern should have been what grades I was getting on my college finals, not what caskets to bury my parents in. My daily life has changed in many ways since the tragedy. The media made my life into a whodunit mystery. I couldn't read the newspaper or watch TV for weeks after it happened because I didn't want to hear about the latest media story on my family. My family and I are very private people, and it is difficult to have my life made so public. It was hardest, however, to hear about my friends being harassed for information about my family and me. They're the only people I have left to depend on. Although I was able to return to school in the fall, there were days when I had to skip class because I could not stop crying about my family. I found that I cannot simply go to movies with my friends. I had to find out what they're about and make sure there's not too much violence. I should not have to worry about that. Recently, a couple of my cousins have gotten married, and what should have been joyous occasions, I cannot stop thinking that my father would never be there to walk me down the aisle. I often dread coming back to Lancaster because I feel like everyone knows who I am. For instance, one day a random store owner gave me her condolences and literally asked me if she could give me a hug. While I appreciate everyone's concern, I really just want to have as normal of a life as possible. Often people outside the area don't know what happened. As a result, I have to actively watch what I say around them if I want to avoid explaining what happened to my family. When I do become friends with someone, I continue to struggle with how to explain my situation. There's no easy way to tell someone that your entire family was murdered. My family was everything to me. They knew everything about me. They're my ultimate support group. Even in college, I would call regularly just to check in. When I was at home, we would all make a pointy dinner together and just talk about our day. One of my parents' greatest qualities was their involvement with their children. My mom volunteered at Manheim Township for years while Kevin and I were in school. She was always driving us to practice, helping us with homework. Every day after school, she would stop whenever she was zoning, just so Kevin and I could tell her about what happened to us that day. My dad worked full-time, but always made time for his family. When Kevin and I were in elementary school, he coached both soccer and baseball. When I ran cross-country and track, he made to every meet and was there cheering me on. even went camping with my brother in the Boy Scouts. Whenever he could, he would stop home and just have lunch with my mom. Some days he'd come home with flowers just to tell her how much he loved her. I've never seen two people more perfect for each other. What I appreciate most, however, is that they supported everything that Kevin and I did. I grew up believing that I could achieve anything I set my mind to. I only hope that I'm half as good a parent as they are. Kevin is my beloved little brother. He had such a bright future ahead of him. He excelled in school and had a passion for learning. Also, he was such a caring kid who had never even heard a fly. The day before he passed away, we were out buying Mother's Day cards for our mom. What hurts me most is that Kevin will never have the opportunity to graduate high school, go to college, get married, start a family. I look forward to being part of Kevin's adult life and having him in mind. In murdering him, Alec Prater not only stole Kevin's future from him, but he stole part of my future from me. Even though the police have told me that there was nothing I could have done to prevent his death, I still feel a sense of guilt that I should have protected him. That is what big sisters do. I would give anything for him to be alive today instead of me. I would have done anything for Kevin. What I find most ironic about this whole situation is that my family was so nonviolent. My parents never laid a hand on me. They always stressed that physical violence was never the answer. Alec Kreider is a despicable individual, and that's saying it lightly. His actions are inexcusable. There is absolutely no justification for what he's done. He stabbed my family to death. I'm not sure that I can ever forgive him for that. He has shown no remorse for his actions. Because of him, I have trouble feeling safe. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night to a strange sound of panic that someone has broken in and will murder me. Even though I know it's probably the wind, this feeling of sheer terror can take hours to go away. That is not how I want to live. If I feel this much anxiety when Alec Kreider is in jail, I cannot imagine how it would function if he was ever released from prison. Even if I had passed away before he was to be released, I would fear for the lives of my future children. I need him to be given consecutive life sentences without parole. I never want him to be free from prison. He does not deserve that. Moreover, I don't trust him not to kill again. I have suffered so much because of him that I need to make certain that he does not have a chance to victimize anyone else. Judge Ashworth, I would appreciate it if you would give Alec Kreider 3 consecutive sentences of life in prison with no chance of parole, because I feel that this is the only suitable punishment for the heinous crimes that he has committed.
Okay, so I know that wasn't the best audio quality, and I apologize for that. I hope you were able to hear what she said and understand her message. If this podcast ever starts making money, I will hire an audio editor. But in the meantime, it's just me and I'm not great at it. But Judge David Ashworth did get Maggie's message. And he did sentence Alec Devin Kreider to 3 consecutive life sentences without parole. Alec was 16 when he committed these crimes. If he had been 18, he would have been eligible for the death penalty. So 3 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole was the maximum sentence that he could have received. Kreider's attorney did file an appeal in 2013, alleging that Alec's therapy journals should not have been admitted into evidence because of doctor-patient privilege. This appeal was denied because the statute of limitations on an appeal like this is limited to 2 years, and that had passed. So, sucks to suck, my friend. Alec's father, Tim Kreider, wrote a book called Refuse to Drown, : A Father's Unthinkable Choice. And this book outlines the way Tim Kreider felt about having to turn his son in for murder. I did not read this book, but I did watch a couple of video interviews with Tim Kreider, and he did many promoting his book. And I have to say, you know, I can't judge a book by its cover. I get it. But Tim Kreider looks like a fucking creep. Like, I shouldn't even say that, but he just has a creepy ass look to him, and I got a weird vibe. And that made me wonder, if there had been a trial, would we have found out more information about why Alec Kreider went down this path? Now, I know that people who come from good families and good parents can still turn bad. I know that. But this is just my own questioning here. What would have come out in a trial about Alec Kreider's life? Was he abused in some way? Did his parents ignore signs of impending violence? I don't know. Now, on Alec Kreider's Wikipedia page, it does mention that he tried to strangle his little brother when he was young. But there's no other detail besides that, so I have no idea. And it's Wikipedia. We can't trust everything it says. But there is a part of me that thinks a trial would have brought out some more information on a motive or on why Alec Kreider became a monster. To be fair, there might be some information on this in the book that I didn't read, so I don't know. But, you know, I always like to throw my questions and opinions in here, and that's something that came to my mind. In 2017, Alec Kreider was given a glimmer of hope to be able to one day get out of prison. Juvenile offenders' life sentences were being re-examined based on the U.S. Supreme Court's 2012 decision in the case of Miller v. Alabama. This states that mandatory life sentences for juveniles without the possibility of parole is unconstitutional. So that meant that any inmates that had been sentenced to life in prison without parole in the United States were now entitled to a resentencing. Not a retrial, but a resentencing. I said that wrong. I have to quickly restate this. Any inmates that had been sentenced to life in prison as a juvenile now had the opportunity for a resentencing. The defense attorney, Robert Bayer, was working on this. So you'd have thought Alec Kreider, you know, would have been in better spirits, possibly. But apparently he wasn't. On January 20th, 2017, Alec Kreider was found dead in his cell. He had taken his own life by passive hanging. He was 15 days shy of his 26th birthday. Now, I had to look up what passive hanging is. This is where a person places a ligature around their neck and ties it to a secure surface, and then uses their body weight to cut off blood flow to the pulmonary artery. But this is not done by hanging. This is done in a kneeling or sitting position. So it takes effort. To me, the name passive hanging makes zero sense because, one, they are not hanging, and two, this is not passive. You literally have to purposely fucking strangle yourself. Now, while I was looking this up, fucking Google autofill. What a shit show. I wanted to find out, like, how long does this process take? So I type in, how long does it take to die? Autofill completes my sentence by, how long does it take to die from death? Well, now I'm interested. So I have to click on it. And by the way, the answer is 5 to 7 minutes. It takes 5 to 7 minutes to die from death, in case you were wondering. Now, to die from, quote, passive hanging, it takes 10 to 15 seconds to pass out, and then up to 2 to 3 minutes to die. But I'm just like, what the fuck, Google? Like, how long does it take to die from death? That's kind of irrelevant, if you ask me. And then they had an actual fucking answer for it. So, okay. Alec Kreider was pronounced dead at 4:31 p.m. on January 20th, 2017. And one last ridiculous statement from defense attorney Robert Bayer. Quote, the reality is, this is a tragic ending to a horrible drama. He was a boy. He's still a boy, and he's dead. That's not good for anybody. End quote. He's not a boy. He was 25 when he died. That's a grown up, in my opinion. And his death is probably actually good for Maggie Haynes. So, that's the story of the Haynes family murders. Disturbing, but interesting. I really didn't expect this to be the longest ever KSOM single episode, but here we are. And can I also mention that I fucking hate the name Alec? No offense to anyone named Alec, but I have to tell you, I had to go back and re-record so many times because I kept saying Alex. I hope all the Keystoners have an amazing holiday or holidays. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy New Year. I will be back in January with more crazy shit. Another year is in the books for KSOM. And, you know, it may not be perfect, but I'm damn proud of it. I have all the Keystoners to thank for the support, the downloads, the listens, the messages, the ratings and reviews, the Patreon subscribers. I love you guys. See you next year. And stay Keystone, my friends.